Speak, O Lord, your servants heareth. Amen. Please be seated. This is one of the appearance stories. They're often called by biblical scholars appearance narratives. And there we've seen in each of the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, appearances by Jesus, and we call those appearance narratives. This is one of the particular ones in the Gospel of John. And I think you may know, you may remember that I get annoyed with John from time to time, but you know what? I love this account. I really do. I love this account. It's very different from all the others. It's different in that this one, there's no drama. It's just, this is the way it is. And that can cause some consternation because this was after the resurrection of Jesus Christ, their master, their teacher, their Lord. And they saw him, at least some of them saw him being put to death, and they had to flee. And they had no idea where he was now, maybe. This is a strange text because it starts off without telling us anything about when it's taking place. Usually, particularly in the book of Mark, but also Matthew and Luke, they'll say, and after this, and after that, 3 days later, and so forth. But this one, this could be the day after the resurrection, it could be the week, the month, it could be years after. We have no idea, and there's no way we can figure it out. Imagining the disciples in the boat fishing, and imagining Peter, I try and think like Peter if I can, and I think I would say, if I were Peter, I would say, I'm going fishing. I mean, he could have said, I'm going fishing, but that wasn't his style. I'm going fishing. And so a couple of the other guys say, yeah, I'll join you. Let's go fishing. Now, they didn't have a cooler or anything like that. These are just ordinary guys that like to go fishing. And in fact, it wasn't that they liked to go fishing as much as it was they had to. This was their livelihood. But now for 3 years, they'd been with Jesus. They'd walked up and down the length of Israel from the north in Galilee all the way down to the south in Jerusalem. And they lived off what people provided them. They didn't have to go fishing. Instead, they just had to receive and be grateful and offer what they had to offer, which was the good news about Jesus Christ coming to them. But the question that's asked by theologians and pastors and lay people since that time, was this a defeat? The fact that they're just kind of hanging around somewhere, you know, maybe the lottery, I don't know. They're hanging around somewhere. And finally someone says, let's go fishing. And the question always is, was there nothing else they could do? Is this the end of the saga? After 3 years of being with Jesus, where their lives had been transformed in ways they could not even begin to understand, and now it was over? Is going fishing a sign of defeat? In fact, the disciples go back to fishing. They go back to ordinary life. Again, is this an act of loss of faith on the part of the disciples? Or is it a true picture of what life is like in Christ after the resurrection? We go back to our ordinary lives. We bring the reality and power of the resurrection to our lives. And so it's not just that we go back to our old lives, it's we go back to our old lives. We go back to our old lives with something new that they had not had before. We go back to our old lives because now we have the power and the experience of being with Jesus Christ. And that they hope will not change. I like this account, as I said, because its appearances are so ordinary, and I'm an ordinary guy, and I can understand ordinary things pretty well. The other appearance narratives are really kind of fraught. You know, there's Mary Magdalene. She goes to the, she's bringing spices to anoint what she thinks is a corpse. And she gets there and she sees somebody there who raking and hoeing, and she says, oh, this must be the gardener. Well, it's not the gardener, it's Jesus. He says her name, and she instantly recognizes who he is, and he's gone. And the others, Peter and John, they hear the story that the tomb is empty. What? And they race each other to get to the tomb to find it's true, the tomb is empty. How can this be? And there's the buildup of excitement and enthusiasm is growing among the disciples. And a week later, Thomas finally shows up. Thomas, the one who made his name famous for the rest of 2,000 years of doubting that Jesus had come back from the dead, Jesus takes Thomas's hand and puts it in his side, said, feel the scar. Feel the scar. Now do you believe? Blessed are those who believe without having seen, without having seeing. They are sent by Jesus back into their old lives, into their ordinary lives, into the day-to-day kind of lives that most of us live, and sometimes we feel like we're just nothing but humdrum. That's the reason I like this story, because I am often humdrum, and this reminds me that even in my humdrumness, I can be a servant of God. And if I can, you can too. Disciples, once called disciples by Jesus, they have a certain task given them. And the task that's given them is really to, well, it's to be like Jesus. You say, well, wait, come on, that's not an ordinary life. He goes around and heals people. Well, look at it closely. That's what we are to do. When Jesus goes into a town, he scopes it out. Where are the needy people? Who are the needy people? Who needs to hear the good news? Who needs to have a healing touch? And Jesus did this everywhere he went, from town to town to town, up and down from, as I said, from Galilee in the south to, in the north to Jerusalem in the south. Healing the sick, providing food for the hungry, forgiving the sins of all who are penitent. In short, to love God, to love the world as God does. I want to read that again. In short, we are to love the world as God does. Jesus calls his disciples to live and act in the world as Jesus did before his crucifixion. Now notice that one of the things that's really characteristic of John's account of Jesus' resurrection and John's account of the whole ministry of Jesus, there's something different from John's account of the Eucharist and the other three Gospels. And the difference is John doesn't have an account of the Eucharist. How can this be? Can you imagine? I mean, you know how central the Eucharist is to Christian worship from the very beginning. It's in all three of the other Gospels. It even appears in one of Paul's letters to the Corinthians. This central act of the Eucharist is missing in John. Remember that just a week or so ago, we had Maundy Thursday service, and there were all of the elements of a Eucharist, but it was no Eucharist, was it? We ended up coming into the sanctuary. You ended up coming into the sanctuary and celebrating Eucharist that way. Though there is no Eucharist in the Gospel of John, there is something else. There are meals all through the Gospel. It's like John is a Cuisinart. He loves food. Every story about Jesus is doing something that involves a meal. It starts with John, the third chapter. What's John, the third chapter? This is the first miracle that Jesus does in the book of John. The first thing that identifies who this person is and gives you some ideas, foreshadowing, that something great and remarkable is going to happen. And what is it? He rescues a wedding. It looks like the wedding is going to go bust because they ran out of wine. And so Jesus says, oh, don't worry about it. I'll take care of the wine. And This is the beginning of John's story about Jesus. It has always to revolve around food, whether it's the woman who washes Jesus' feet with her tears, or whether it's visiting Simon the leper, or visiting one of the other Pharisees in town. They all take place around a meal. So it's no surprise when the disciples get out of the boat and they haul those nets teeming with fish, that what would Jesus do? Let's have breakfast. This is so important to John that he keeps hammering it. What is there about breakfast? What is there about the meal? What is there about these gatherings together around which food is shared? Why? And when we look at John's message, overall message, we find this. John recognizes that ordinary people who live ordinary lives also may be missing something essential. They may be hungry. They may be starving. They may need clothes. They may need shelter. Jesus comes into their reality carrying these gifts of life. And the centerpiece, the thing that jumps out at you, it's always around a meal. There's a recognition at the time that this was written down that people were starving to death all throughout the region. The area had become so corrupt under the temple leadership, the Pharisaical leadership, but also the Roman leadership under the governor of Rome, the governor of Palestine, who serves the Caesar in Rome. People were starving to death because of cruelty and because of corruption. And so Jesus comes in, and he establishes the way the Christian church is going to be. And that is, it's always going to be looking at those who suffer. The Christian church is always going to be finding those people who have no food. The Christian church will be that institution, that group of people that will always be ready to help, assist, and aid those who are poor. If you look at organizations around the world, there's many fine organizations that do truly great and wonderful things. There's something unique about the churches. And whether it's our churches, the Lutheran and Episcopal churches, it's very clear the Lutherans and Episcopalians are adamant that taking care of food, of providing food for the poor, is absolutely essential. It is at the heart of what we do as Christians. But we're not the only ones. Other groups and organizations do the same. But the churches are the ones who do it because it was done for them. And they do it because it's how they live their ordinary daily lives. They live their ordinary daily lives, experiencing the power of the crucifixion, carrying that into the world in which they live. Eventually, in time, this act of the meal becomes embedded in Christian worship. It becomes embedded in every story the future preachers will talk about. Whenever we talk about John, we're going to expect to hear a word about the hungry. And we're going to expect to find churches or organizations finding ways to meet the needs of those who are hungry. Eventually, this act becomes a central act in the life of the Christian church. It's not, oh, we have Eucharist here, and over after that we have a meal. Or we have a meal some days and not other days. For the early church, that meal was central to who they were as followers of Jesus Christ. It became a part of welcoming the foreigner. For John, this is of the utmost importance in the task of the disciples, the task that Jesus gives his disciples. At the center of the faith, at the center of their practice, is what? Feeding the hungry. This is the heart of the Christian faith. And we celebrate the presence of the one who calls us to a meal. We celebrate the presence of Jesus Christ that way. Serving meals is essential to the gospel. Now you can imagine what gospel the story of Mary and Martha is in, right? John. Remember the conflict between Mary and Martha, right? I mean, that Mary wants to sit at Jesus' feet and take in all the teachings, and Martha's in this scrubbing up the pans and cleaning out the potatoes and trying to get things ready so we can actually have a meal instead of standing around waiting for somebody else who will never get into the kitchen to do anything. That meal is absolutely central to the Christian faith. And it's not even the Eucharist. So when we put the two together, what we have is the Eucharist is the presence of Christ leading us out into the world to transform the world through the presence of Christ in our lives because of the resurrection. We serve Christ and love our neighbor. It is a form of welcome which stands at the heart of the gospel and the Christian faith. Now quickly, I want to say something about Saul. Saul, you know, that we all know the story. Saul is on his way to Damascus. He has letters to take to the synagogue in Damascus to, if there are any followers of the way, that is, that's the earliest name for the Christians. They were called the way. If there are any followers of the way that I, Paul, have the authority from the central office in Jerusalem to bind them and bring them back to Jerusalem to be tried for heresy. Saul was at the heart of that. Saul was the leader of that. Saul couldn't wait to get everyone because he saw what these followers of the way were doing was destroying Jewish faith. That Saul has the authority to bring people to jail in Jerusalem. And Saul, on the way, what happens? What happens to Saul on the way to Damascus? Pardon?
The
Lord called him. Have you seen, there's a great Caravaggio painting of Paul, or then Saul, on a great white steed. Has anybody seen that famous painting? Jesus is up on this huge white steed and he's pulling the reins back and he can't hold on to him and down he goes. There's no horse in this story. There's no donkey in this story. It's all made up by artists who have leave to do such things. But he's knocked to the ground and he's made blind. And then this poor guy Ananias, who is clearly a new Christian. I mean, he's been following Jesus for only a short. We know nothing really about him. The voice of God comes to Ananias. Ananias, wake up! There's a guy by the name of Saul that's going to come to you. He's blind, and I want you to lay your hands on him and help him regain his sight. And Ananias, who's a prophet of Jesus, says, are you crazy? This is what all prophets do when they get the message. He said, what? Are you crazy? Don't you read the papers? This guy is a threat. He's a danger to us all. If he finds out where we are, we'll all be bound and carried back in chains to Jerusalem. What are you doing, Lord? And the voice comes back and says, I have chosen him to be my instrument to the Gentiles. Don't you diss him. Well, he didn't say that. He would have, right? I mean, you know that. So Ananias is terrified because he does not want to come into contact with this guy who's got the authority to put him in prison. But when God tells you to go, you go. He goes. At this moment, this is one of the most, you know, there are a few places in history where if a battle had gone this way rather than that, the world would be very different. This is one of those moments. In this moment, these two figures are standing face to face. One can see and one cannot. The one who cannot see would be the enemy of the one who can. And the one who can see is clearly afraid of the one who cannot. And so they stand there. And what must it have been like? The terror in Ananias' life as he's standing and looking at this person who's caused so much mayhem in the Christian community. But you do what God says, and he puts his hands on Ananias, and his eyes open. It says it's like scales fell from his eyes. We don't know how to describe it, so we use words like scales fell from his eyes. And a connection is made in that moment. And Paul ends up getting baptized and stays for a while and goes off and is beginning to go to the Gentiles to preach. In this confrontation of Paul of Saul and Ananias, if it had gone another way, if Ananias had said, nothing doing, this is crazy. I mean, you know, I'm willing to give up my life for a lot of things, but not when I know the guy's going to kill me, or at least he's going to throw me into the dungeon. I'm not going to do it. If that had happened, that would have been so reasonable. It's what I would have done, perhaps. At that moment of confrontation, at that moment, it could have all gone awry. If Ananias had said, nothing doing, then the Christian movement, the Jesus movement, probably would have died out in a generation or two. And the whole world would know nothing of Christians because they wouldn't exist. This moment, when Ananias says, okay, in that moment, history opens up and something brand new happens that never happened before. And it's all because Ananias, like the disciples, did what they had to do in their daily life. They lived out their daily life in the power of the resurrection. We are here today because of the courage and faithfulness of a handful of people like Ananias and those disciples. Let us give thanks. Amen.